Chris Liv Kulich, attorney registration number 39412. Good afternoon. Simon Sue was only 21 years old when he pled guilty and was sentenced to 53 years in prison. For the past 10 years, Mr. Sue has been trying to do the one thing he wanted to do immediately after his sentencing, and that was file a direct appeal of his sentence. But each time he files a post-conviction motion, the rules change against him, and he's prevented from proceeding on that appeal because of reasons that he cannot foresee. In 2004, he filed a Crim P 35A motion challenging a sentence under Apprendi. That motion was denied by the trial court. Mr. Sue indicated he wanted then to proceed claims under 35C. The trial court told him to first appeal the 35A motion and to ask for a limited remand from the Court of Appeals to pursue 35C issues. Mr. Sue did just as instructed by the trial court, but the Court of Appeals denied the motion for limited remand. After the denial of his 35A was upheld, Mr. Sue then filed a Crim P 35C motion with the trial court. However, at that time, when the people argued that Mr. Sue's original 35A motion was in fact a 35C motion, so the rules had changed against Mr. Sue again. Although he had been trying to comply with the rules and instructions by the court, he was now being told that he couldn't file a 35C. Nonetheless, Mr. Sue, through second post-conviction counsel, Mr. Noble, did file a 35C motion alleging the ineffectiveness of plea counsel. And the trial court ruled that initially that motion was not a successive petition, that he could proceed on that. So because of that reliance, Mr. Sue and his attorney, Mr. Noble, only proceeded on claims of ineffectiveness against plea counsel and not against initial post-conviction counsel, Ms. Fite. However, at the end of the evidentiary hearing, the rules against Mr. Sue changed again, and now the trial court, its ruling said that the motion was in fact successive. Although there was an evidentiary hearing at that time also on the ineffectiveness of plea counsel, and the trial court made findings that the counsel was effective, that matter has not been fully and finally litigated. Although there have been several post-conviction pleadings and hearings and appeals on Mr. Sue's issue, the real issue at heart has never actually been litigated, and that's whether or not plea counsel was ineffective for failing to file a notice of direct appeal, and whether initial post-conviction counsel Ms. Fite was ineffective for not alleging in the initial proceedings that plea counsel was ineffective.
You say it was never litigated, but it was subject of a hearing, and when you say it's not litigated, you mean it was never resolved by this court?
I agree. Yes, there was evidence presented on the issue of plea counsel's effectiveness. The trial court did make rulings and denied the motion. That motion was appealed to the appellate court, but the appellate court only decided the issue as to whether or not that motion was successive and did not resolve the issue as to plea counsel's effectiveness.
Is there any reason why we can't look at that record? It's part of the record. Look at that hearing and review that.
I don't see a reason why the court would not be able to do that.
And if it's determined, if we were to determine that the record supports the trial court's at least initial ruling that plea counsel were not ineffective, wouldn't that obviate any claims against subsequent post-conviction counsel for not alleging ineffectiveness of predecessor counsel based on the ineffectiveness of plea counsel?
I believe, if I understand correctly, it would be that if...
It's a complicated question.
It is, and it's a complicated case with a lengthy history. And so whether or not, if the appellate court decides that plea counsel was effective, then if subsequent post-conviction counsel would be... It wouldn't have to determine whether or not they were ineffective for failing to allege claims of ineffectiveness against plea counsel.
That's the essence of my question.
Yes, I think so, because the ultimate issue is whether or not plea counsel was effective or ineffective in failing to file a notice of appeal. So that's the main issue here.
Okay.
And the issues that have never been decided, and there may be more to my answer than that as I continue on, but it's whether or not Mr. Sue's plea counsel was ineffective for failing to file a notice of direct appeal. And then whether or not that in itself is ineffectiveness. And in this case, the merits of the appeal are not an issue for this decision. It's just whether or not he lost his right to an appeal. And that would be per se ineffectiveness on behalf of his city council.
Is there a requirement under present Colorado law that there be a showing that there was meritorious grounds for proceeding with that appeal as a predicate for an ineffective assistance for failure and depriving you of your right to appeal?
That's not my understanding. I think that the only precedent is whether or not, if Mr. Sue directed his plea counsel to file an appeal, then their failure to do so in and of itself is ineffectiveness. The prejudice is not the merits of the appeal, but losing your right to the appeal itself. And then if it is determined that Mr. Sue did not directly ask his plea counsel to file the appeal, then it's to be a determination as to whether or not plea counsel should have known that Mr. Sue wanted to file an appeal, or if a reasonable defendant in Mr. Sue's position would want an appeal to be filed. But the merits of the appeal itself are not, don't need to be decided. And that's in the people's answer brief in this case. They suggest that Mr. Sue is required to prove to this appellate court that his 35C issues had merit and would be granted by a trial court. But that's not the state of the law in Colorado as well. All Mr. Sue is required to do is allege facts in his petition that, if are true, would grant him relief. Under the people's argument in this case, they would propose a standard that if a defendant files a 35C petition with the trial court could deny it summarily, and then the defendant would have to now prove his 35C issue to the appellate court, which is something that the appellate courts have been trying to do away with. They would rather have the 35C issues litigated at the trial court rather than the appellate court, where an evidentiary hearing can be held and testimony given, as opposed to trying to prove these claims on paper. And if there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Jones. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. And this is an appeal of the denial of the defendant's third post-conviction motion in this case. The post-conviction motion in this case is untimely, successive, and ultimately fails on the merits. Now, the defendant's conviction became final back in October of 2003. The mandate issued following Attorney Fite's representation on May 16, 2007. The defendant did not raise any claims against Attorney Fite until over 3 years later, in October of 2010, despite the fact that Attorney Noble filed a motion for post-conviction relief back in 2006, alleging ineffective assistance of plea counsel. And there's the same situation with Attorney Noble. In that case, the mandate issued in November of 2010, following Attorney Noble's representation in the second appeal. But the defendant didn't raise ineffective assistance of counsel claims against Attorney Noble until the following April, despite the fact that he had raised...
How long a period of time was that?
Approximately 5 months, Your Honor. However, the defendant did file a pro se motion for post-conviction relief prior to the mandate issuing after the Court of Appeals opinion was announced, wherein he alleged ineffective assistance of both Attorney Fite and Attorney Castle, but he did not at that point include Attorney Noble in his motion for ineffective assistance of counsel.
And what makes 5 months sufficient that there wouldn't have been justifiable excuse or excusable neglect for that amount of delay?
Well, initially, it's the defendant's obligation to allege justifiable excuse and excusable neglect in his motion that he files in the trial court. But again, the idea behind 35C is that we raise all available claims in a single proceeding. The claims against Attorney Noble were available at the time that the defendant filed his claim alleging ineffective assistance of Fite and Castle. The claim was available to him at that time. He did not proceed on that claim until he was well into his claim against Attorneys Fite and Castle, and the people filed a response indicating that those claims were in fact successive. But at that point that he went on to allege ineffective assistance of Noble.
So you're suggesting that, I'm not sure if I understand this, let me make sure I understand. Defendant should have filed his motion alleging ineffective assistance of Mr. Noble before the appeal had been resolved.
Well, now, of course, he can't, the trial court, of course, is without jurisdiction at that time to hear that. However, what the defendant did here was ask the court, he filed his motion and asked the court to hold it in abeyance pending the issuance of the mandate in that case. So the defendant could have done the same thing, or upon issuance of the mandate, the defendant could have filed a motion alleging ineffective assistance of Attorney Noble, but he didn't do that either.
And is that a good policy to be encouraging defendants to file ineffective assistance claims against post-conviction counsel while appeals are pending? Aren't we just going to be increasing the number of these motions if we do that?
Honestly, I don't think it's going to increase the number of motions. The defendant could either file it and ask the trial court to hold it in abeyance, or he can wait until the mandate issues and file it at that time.
Is he obliged to have filed it during dependency of an appeal?
No, of course not.
Okay, so then what makes 5 months following the end of the appeal sufficiently long that we should not consider it to be within the realm, or at least remand it for the possibility of justifiable excuse or excusable neglect?
Well, again, the defendant should have raised justifiable excuse or excusable neglect in the trial court. It was his obligation to include that in his motion regarding why he didn't bring these claims earlier. He didn't do that. But even if this court were to find that the 5 months wasn't sufficient to conclude that this motion was untimely, the motion is still successive. And the motion is successive both because it could have been raised before, and also because, as this court found on appeal of the second post-conviction motion, basically what this claim is the exact same claim that was raised in the first post-conviction motion.
Which would have had merit had a direct appeal been taken and resolved. Isn't that correct?
Assuming that the defendant's case was pending on direct appeal when Blakely was announced, he would have been entitled to relief under Blakely. Yes, that's true. But that's not what this court said in its decision following the second appeal. What it said was that basically the defendant's ineffective assistance of counsel claim in that case is based on plea counsel's failure to file a direct appeal and challenge his sentence. And the court acknowledged that even though this was framed differently than the original appeal, where he was just challenging his sentence under Apprendi and Blakely, he was really seeking the same relief, which was in fact a reduction of his sentence because it was illegally aggravated under Apprendi and Blakely. And that claim had been previously resolved in the initial post-conviction appeal. So the court found in the second appeal that that claim was successive for the very reason that it was nothing more than renaming the original appeal and calling it something different when in fact seeking the same result.
But is it really just renaming it when the cause for the failure to have raised the claim directly in a timely manner, which might have got him relief, was based on counsel's alleged ineffectiveness? Is that the same claim? Is ineffectiveness of counsel, is it always merged with the underlying claim?
No, Your Honor, but I think in this case what the defendant is asking for is relief under Blakely, which is what he was asking for in his first post-conviction motion, and again in his second post-conviction motion, and now for a third time in this post-conviction motion.
He is asking for that relief. That's exactly right. But isn't he asking it saying, gee, if my lawyer had done as I instructed him originally, or her originally, I would be entitled to that relief? In other words, okay, Blakely doesn't allow me to have that relief, but the failure of my counsel to take appropriate steps at the appropriate time allows me to get that relief at this time. That's a different claim.
It is, and if the court wants to look at the merits of that argument, then, of course, we do have a hearing on this. The trial court heard testimony from plea counsel and from the defendant and made findings on whether or not counsel was ineffective in failing to file a direct appeal in this case. And of course, the first question that we have to look at is whether or not there was a specific instruction from the defendant to his attorneys to file a direct appeal. And the trial court in this case found that there was not. The defendant indicated that he was unhappy with his sentence.
Excuse me. I don't recall seeing anything where the court said he did not. My recollection is that the court declined to decide which person was telling the truth about that.
Well,
and went ahead and said it didn't matter.
I think the court ultimately initially credited Kaufman's testimony. And the court went on to say, but it doesn't matter here because, and then went further. But I think that the court ultimately did find that the defendant here had not specifically instructed his attorney that he wanted an appeal. And the record supports that.
Can you give me a record cite to what you're looking at there, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. It says here that, let's see, at the beginning, and this is in volume 19, pages 139-41, the court is reviewing the testimony. He talks about Kaufman and Levinson, how they talked with the defendant, analyzed the situation, and what would be the best way to proceed. Then they went on to say that the defendant stated, let's appeal. He found that Ms. Kaufman testified to the contrary. But before that, he had also credited Ms. Kaufman's testimony. And that's on...
Yes, I recall that he found her credible, but I don't recall that the court ever made a finding that there was no instruction to appeal.
Well, again, this court, of course, can review the record on that. I think that the court did go through and analyze whether or not counsel discussed this issue with the defendant, whether or not, based on the relief he was seeking, a direct appeal would be viable in this case. Of course, at the time that they were making the decision about whether or not to file a direct appeal, there was no relief under Blakely or Apprendi for the defendant at that time. What the defendant was really after was a reduction of his sentence.
Did the court make findings about that? That basically after consultations with the defendant, they all agreed to go forward with the reduction of sentence rather than the appeal?
They did say that they made a strategic decision to go forward with the 35B, that would be the most effective to get the defendant what he wanted.
But did the court's finding indicate that the defendant had agreed with that decision?
See, the court specifically found that they had discussed the matter with the defendant and his family multiple times following the sentencing hearing. They discussed the avenues of the appeal in a general sense, and they discussed which remedies to pursue, and that their decisions were in fact strategic rather than the result of any negligence on their part. Court also found that this matter had been discussed with the defendant, with Attorney Castle as well. But again, the court can go back and look at both the testimony of Kaufman and Levinson and the defendant. And in this case, if there was no specific instruction to file a direct appeal, then the court has to go on to look at whether or not they consulted with the defendant and made a reasonable effort to determine the defendant's wishes. And in that case, the court did make specific findings that they did discuss this with the defendant, that what they thought he was after was a reduction in his sentence, and that they found that the best way to achieve that for the defendant was filing a crim pro 35B motion. And finally, even if this court were to determine that there was no consultation, even though the record specifically indicates that there was, the court has to go on to find out whether or not the attorney had an affirmative duty to consult, and whether or not his failure to consult was deficient performance. And in looking at whether or not there's a duty to consult, the court has to take into account that this was a guilty plea, that this was not a conviction following a trial. And the court can also look at the fact that the defendant did receive a sentence that he bargained for. In this case, the stipulated sentencing range was 40 to 60 years, and the defendant received a sentence of 53 years, which was basically the midpoint of the sentencing range that he agreed to. And again, there's no reason that the attorneys in this case would file a direct appeal unless specifically instructed by the defendant, because there were no meritorious issues. The defendant was not entitled to relief, and to assume that his attorneys were somehow ineffective for their failure to anticipate that Blakely would subsequently be announced while his case was pending, that simply doesn't amount to ineffective assistance of counsel. So again, it's the people's position that this third post-conviction motion is untimely, successive, and fails on the merits. If the court has no further questions, we would ask that this court affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Souter's motions are not successive, they're not untimely, and they do not fail on the merits. The claims against Ms. Fite are not untimely. The issue as to her, she got involved in the case in 2004, and there's a hearing held in 2005. After the initial post-conviction proceeding was denied by the trial court, Mr. Sue appealed that decision. And even after the appeal, the denial was upheld, Mr. Sue had not yet been prejudiced by Ms. Fite's performance. After that appeal, through Mr. Noble, Mr. Sue filed a 35C petition against plea counsel. At that point, then, the prosecution filed an objection stating that that motion was successive and those claims should have been brought by Mrs. Fite. However, the trial court, before the evidentiary hearing, made a ruling that that motion was not successive. Therefore, there was no need for Mr. Noble or Mr. Sue to raise any claims against Mrs. Fite for her failure to raise claims against plea counsel. It wasn't until the end of the evidentiary hearing with Mr. Noble that the trial court then said, yes, this is excessive, these claims should have been brought in against Ms. Fite, not against plea counsel. And then that ruling was appealed. Pending that appeal, Mr. Sue was still represented by Mr. Noble. He could not have filed ineffective assistance of counsel claim against Mr. Noble while that was pending. And then within 5 months afterwards, and I won't even say 5 months, because after the second appeal was upheld, Mr. Noble was again appointed by the trial court to represent Mr. Sue. I believe the mandate came down in November, and then in March is when Mr. Noble filed a motion with the court asking for unconflicted counsel to be appointed. So the motions were timely, and they're not successive because none of these claims against Ms. Fite and Mr. Noble could have been raised until now. As to the issues of plea counsel,
I take it your excusable neglect justifying an excuse for failure to file fairly quickly after the second appeal was Mr. Noble's continued involvement in the case?
That's one of the reasons, yes. And I think that he was justifiably excused because it's not a lengthy time period. And I also believe that because Mr. Noble was continuing to represent Mr. Sue.
Did you allege justifiable excuse or excusable neglect pursuant to Klaus and Klaus case in your motion when you went alleged Mr. Noble's ineffectiveness?
Mr. Sue, it was a pro se motion filed by himself. I can't recall off the top of my head if Mr. Sue did allege justifiable excuse. I don't know if Mr. Sue is required to do so in his motion, because it's a motion against ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel.
Do you think under Klaus you have 3 years to raise it?
Well, you would have 3 years, but in this, under the statute, you have 3 years to raise a claim, but in this case, Mr. Sue's ineffectiveness, or Mr. Noble and Mrs. Fite's ineffectiveness, did not come about until after the 3 year time period had passed, so it would be impossible for him to do.
Well, have you read Klaus?
Yes, I have.
Okay, do you remember Klaus, I think, doesn't present sequential three-year periods of time, depending upon when council's representation ends. Says there's a three-year period under the statute, and then for each council, there's a just filed excusable neglect period.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay, so you're not looking at an automatic three-year period. The question is, once you're outside that three-year period, what justifiable excuse or excusable neglect exists to allow that later filing? And we're going to give you another minute, counsel, because I'm taking up so much time with that question. So would you give another minute, bailiff, please? Thank you.
The justifiable excuse in Mr. Sue's case and is that he cannot have, that no prejudice had been realized.
And you know what? I don't want to take much time on this. The real question is, should he have had to have alleged justifiable excuse, excusable neglect? That's my question.
Yeah. I'm not aware of any case law that makes him allege that specifically in his 35C. The cases that I cited in my motion, when there has been a dispute as to justifiable excuse or excusable neglect, is not for to be resolved at the appellate court, so it is to remain it to the trial court, at least for that, for hearing to determine whether or not justifiable excuse or excusable neglect has been met. But I didn't read anything in the cases saying that the defendant must raise it on his own in his 35C petition. And I think even though the trial court at the second evidentiary hearing did make findings as to the effectiveness of Ms. Kaufman and Mr. Levinson, doesn't mean that those findings are correct. And that's why a case and an issue has not been fully and finally litigated until an appellate court has had a chance to weigh in on those issues. Although the trial court made a decision that plea counsel was effective in reading through the transcripts, that decision doesn't entirely seem to be based on the record or on the correct application of the law. I think at one point the trial court says that Mr. Sue may have asked for a direct appeal. Ms. Kauf and Mr. Levinson may have said that he didn't, and the court said it doesn't matter who asked for what. But actually, it doesn't. It's very important who asked for what. The trial court also stated in its ruling that it's clear that Mr. Sue wanted to appeal his case, but an appeal can mean many things, such as a 35B or 35A motion, but an appeal means an appeal, and that's what Mr. Sue has been trying to get for all these years. And then also, the record is not as clear as the people make it seem to be, that Mr. Levinson and Ms. Kaufman discussed with the defendant the options to proceed by appeal or by 35B motion. It seems more on the record that counsel decided that they would proceed by a 35B, and Mr. Sue may have said, okay, we can do that, but counsel didn't also, it's not on the record that they also told Mr. Sue they're doing that in lieu of an appeal, but just that they would be doing a 35B motion. It's not logical that Mr. Sue would want to proceed first with a motion under 35, Rule 35, as opposed to an appeal, because had counsel filed a direct appeal as instructed and that appeal was denied, Mr. Sue still has the option then after that to file motions under 35. However, if you file a motion under 35 as opposed to doing an appeal, you can't then later file an appeal if your Rule 35 motion is denied.
After the, I think he asked, the quote that you're relying on that you said where I want to appeal, and that occurred upon the sentence, and he told that to counsel that day, right?
That's correct.
And then he never said again, he never asked if he filed a direct appeal, or he never talked about an appeal after that, right? Am I wrong on that?
Mr. Sue did give testimony at the evidentiary hearing, and I don't know if that question was ever asked of him.
But we're supposed, is the part of the premise of your argument here that because nobody told me at 45 days, he was entitled to believe that the appeal could be filed at any time?
Then yes, that is it. Even if Mr. Sue did not, if he asked for an appeal directly after the sentence was imposed and then never asked for it again, it's because plea counsel never told him, well, we need to do this within 45 days. and here's a procedure we need to follow. And that's, he was not counseled on his right to an appeal and what he needed to do to get that. So it is our request that the court does grant Mr. Sue's appeal and remand the case to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted. Any wish in due course. Thank you.